From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Corlott, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and welcome to Worldviews. Today, I'll talk with political scientist Keith Gaddy about the deadly Ebola outbreak in West Africa and the 100th anniversary of the First World War.
What's going on between Ukraine and Russia is a consequence of the unraveling of the Russian Empire. And also, you look at the Middle East, where the arbitrary lines drawn by the British, the unraveling of the Ottoman Empire.
Then I'm joined by economist Musa Blimpo. He says access to education in Africa has grown tremendously over the past two decades, but that doesn't necessarily mean students learn as much as they could.
And as a result of that, many countries are trying to see if there is a way to have some component of their education system that would involve the early childhood. And that's not the case in most African countries.
The economics of education in developing countries. But first, the news. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Corlott. Keith Gaddy, thank you for joining me today on Worldviews.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Keith, we're witnessing the worst outbreak of the deadly Ebola virus right now in Western Africa, countries of Guinea, Sierra Leone, Liberia primarily, although it's now migrated to Nigeria. And we have even some reports from elsewhere. About 2,000 cases of infection, approximately 1,000 deaths so far, the worst on record. The World Health Organization is considering an international public health emergency. And even the U.S. is in action now, bringing back a couple of American aid workers to Atlanta to treat them as they were there helping those who were infected and ended up infected themselves. So this raises an issue of treatment and medical access to medical care and the ethics of removing some people and bringing them back to the U.S. and leaving others in Africa to suffer. What are we to make of this major outbreak? This isn't the only time we're going to deal with this.
Yeah, well, you know, and there are two sets of ethical issues at here. One is the matter of what kind of treatments we have available medically and who receives that treatment. We've removed American aid workers from the region in West Africa, brought them back to Atlanta, where Centers for Disease Control is, which is the best, most controlled, most scientifically advanced environment to pursue novel and experimental treatments. And when it comes to novel and experimental treatment, we always treat on test subjects before we go to the general population. So it's not surprising that we're not trying an unproven treatment on the general population. But the bigger ethical issue is, why did we wait for aid workers to get infected when we had many infected individuals, at least one of whom might have volunteered to come back and receive treatment in the U.S.? The other ethical issue, though, has to do with the public health issue on the ground, that local custom and practice regarding the handling of the dead actually promotes further spread of this disease. It can only be spread through bodily contact and fluid contact. And the tradition of actually holding a dead person or an ill person in room, touching them, nursing them through the family, actually promotes the spread of the disease. And that's part of the problem with this outbreak.
Well, hopefully we'll see an end coming to this soon, and maybe some of these treatments, these experimental treatments, will work. I mean, this disease has a mortality rate up to 90%. So clearly, this is an emergency if I've ever seen one. So we'll continue to watch that. Well, from current events to history, let's look back 100 years. We commemorated this week the 100th anniversary of the beginning of the First World War, or at least when Britain entered the war after Germany invaded Belgium in early August. Of course, the First World War at that time was known as the Great War, 4 years of war that left about 16 million people dead, 9 million combatants, 7 million civilians. World War I changed war fundamentally, the technology available at the time, the inclusion of chemical weapons and aerial bombing. But here we are 100 years later, embroiled still in many places around the world in war. You would think that this great war would have taught us a lesson. Why not?
Well, because man kills man, and because we have nations and tribes and morality and conflict. And we always have. It's just that now we have the technology and the ability to kill on a mass scale. And World War I is really the beginning of the 20th century. It's the first, but we call it the Great War not because it was awesome, but because it was massive. And it was almost an incomprehensibly large war. But if you look at the issues that are unleashed between the collapse of empires in Central and Eastern Europe, we still deal with the consequences of that today. Ukraine, what's going on between Ukraine and Russia is a consequence of the unraveling of the Russian Empire. We look at the disputes in the Balkans. This is a consequence of the unraveling of the Habsburgs in Austro-Hungary. But and also you look at the Middle East, where the arbitrary lines drawn by the British, the unraveling of the Ottoman Empire. we continue to deal with all those issues today. These are the hot points in terms of global conflict to this day, and they don't go away. But then also issues of weapons of mass destruction begin with World War I. The first time we had ever banned a weapon is after World War I. So this event, this epic event, I recommend Barbara Tuchman's Guns of August, anybody who's interested in the beginnings of this war. It defines the globe to this day. In many ways, we are still in World War I.
Well, this comment you made initially about human nature can't help but remember the UK Prime Minister David Lloyd George saying at the end of the First World War, this war, like the next war, is a war to end war. So perhaps we can't learn that lesson.
I think we're just still working on the end.
Well, thank you very much, Keith, once again for joining us on Worldviews. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Pleasure to be here, Suzette.
And if you have any comments or questions for me or Keith, let us know on the Worldviews page of KGOU.org. You can also leave your comments on KGOU's Facebook page or get in touch with us on Twitter at WorldviewsKGOU or at Suzette Gorlot and at OU Keith Gaddy. Next, I'll talk about the economics of education in West Africa with economist Musa Blimpo. I'm Suzette Gorlot, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlot. My guest, Musa Blimpo, studies development economics with a focus on education. He's a native of Togo and since 2012 has served as an assistant professor of international and area studies here at the University of Oklahoma. Musa Blimpo, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
Well, Musa, you've spent a lot of time in Africa. Obviously, you come from the country of Togo. And as an economist, you've spent a significant amount of time looking at development activities and the ways in which African countries in particular are able to develop, really focusing largely on education and early childhood education, for example. So tell us a little bit about that. I know some of your research interestingly focuses on investing in early childhood education as a way in which you can really boost socioeconomic outcomes. So tell us what you know about that.
Yeah, so to answer correctly to this question, you have to understand the broader picture of the entire field of development economics, where for over 50 years, it was focused more on big questions, how to develop a country, how to grow a country. But we've realized over time that these are nearly unanswerable questions. Nobody was able to come up with a set of policies that would take the countries or the continent as a whole from one place to the other. And as a result of that, there's been a shift to focus on smaller issues where we can do very focused and narrow research and have questions and answers that could inform policy. And as far as education is concerned, the reason why I'm particularly interested in early childhood investment is because the educational outcome in Africa, you know, for example, the past 20 years, what you see and what has been celebrated is the growth of access to education. A lot of kids are getting to school more than before, but they're not necessarily learning, and the learning outcomes are extremely poor, and people are looking at ways to improve that. And there's some research that suggested that a lot of time, as far as cognitive development is concerned, the first 3 years of a child are crucial. They are crucial in terms of what they're able to learn later on. And as a result of that, many countries are trying to see if there is a way to have some component of their education system that would involve the early childhood. And that's not the case in most African countries. So we're doing some research in the Gambia, for example, in this particular area to try and figure out whether, you know, that helps and whether any head start that kids get during that period of their life does persist over time to justify this kind of investment.
So what's interesting is that it's not so much access anymore. I think that's an interesting point to make, but that the quality of the education once they're in school. Now, when you say the first 3 years, are you talking about the first 3 years of school or?
No, of the child.
Okay. So
their life.
So the first 3 years of a child's life,
yes.
that kind of attention to their, I guess, as we might say, kind of a Head Start program, that you're preschool.
Yes,
you're talking about preschool access,
yes.
Not just early childhood in terms of elementary school, but preschool
exactly.
education.
Exactly.
So then let's get to this issue of the learning outcomes themselves. So what are some of the specific things then, now that kids are having access, what are the recommendations based on your research that you've made in terms of the specific changes that can take place to affect better outcomes?
So there are many levels. So I've done research in the area of early childhood investment, but I've done research and evaluated other type of policies. So I would talk about two particular instances. For example, in Benin, one of the research that I've done looked at the incentives of the kids themselves. When you take a 7-10 years old to school, what is the incentive that they have to actually work hard and learn a lot? For most of us who come from families, well, it's not the case for me, but most of the kids who come from well-off and well-educated families, they have some incentives within the family, encouragement and parent actually following how the kid is doing and all that to motivate the kids. But for other kids who don't have that kind of support, what is needed basically is to say, okay, go to school now and you got a better job 20 years down the road. We can expect 7 years old or 10 years old to have that kind of calculus to work hard in school. So there need to be some extra incentives for those kids who come from disadvantaged or poor families who don't necessarily have that infrastructure at home. So I gave incentives to kids, very basic incentive. I say, if you do well at the end of the year, you know, I give you something, I give you a gift. And then I found in a group of kids that received that kind of incentive that they did, and I found like it was a certification exam. I found up to 11% more passing rate among the group of kids who received the incentive that you will be rewarded if you do better. Then, so this says that there is a room there to tap on the students' own incentive. In Gambia, we've done work in the area of decentralization. And the argument there is that the school system has grown a lot because access has been expanded, but management has become a problem. The ministries don't have the resources and the skills anymore to control all the schools. I remember when I was in primary school, every year, two or three times, some guy will show up in my classroom and sit in the back and then monitor my teacher. And usually he would be nice those days, and I didn't know what it was. But, you know, I learned later on these were inspectors making sure that teachers are actually teaching kids and doing what they're supposed to do. Now they can't do that because there are so many schools and it's just too crowded. So what we are trying in Gambia is to say, okay, let's give more autonomy to villages, give them more local control of schools and see whether that can improve learning outcome. And we ran a 4-year-long research that costed over $1 million. This project was funded by the World Bank to study that aspect. Unfortunately, what came out of this kind of this study is basically that, you know, at the local level, they might know better their problems, but a lot of time they don't have the skill to manage them. When it comes to the bottom line, like, you know, parents, they care about their kids. They know what the teachers are doing. They can monitor them. But they can't sit on curriculum management committees. They can't actually know what teachers and head teachers are really supposed to do. Because remember, it's the context of rural Africa where the parents don't have education themselves. And if I take my own example, and coming back to the idea of early childhood investment, when I started the first grade, that was the first time I started hearing some French word. So the first grade is in French, but I come from a family where nobody was educated. And so I speak no word of French, and I was supposed to be able to perform among other kids who may come from parents who are working in the public sector and speak some French and all that. So as a result of that, I had to fail the first grade. And thank God I failed the first grade. Thank God that there were some testing that you have to pass before you can go to the second grade. And, you know, so I failed the first grade, and then I was able to pick up from there and move on. So these are the kind of policies that people are exploring in developing world. So as far as Africa is concerned, in many African countries, you have a lot of research in this area to try and find out what kind of policies can improve learning outcomes over time.
That's University of Oklahoma economist and International and Area Studies Professor Musa Blimpo. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. I'm Suzette Gralat, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gralat, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. My guest today is Musa Blimpo, a professor of International and Area Studies at the University of Oklahoma. He studies development in Africa with a focus on education. Right before we left off, he described work in the Gambia to give more autonomy and local control to villages in order to improve the performance outcome of students. I want to ask the question about parents. I mean, you've mentioned them a couple of times, you know, the fact that parental involvement, or at least parental encouragement, parental awareness of what's going on in school, parental interest even in their children's education. But what more is it? I mean, you just made some reference to, can they, you know, play a role in curriculum? Are they, how connected are they to teachers? I mean, are you seeing things like this happening, parent-teacher type organizations in Africa emerging where parents are becoming more involved and that having an impact on these learning outcomes?
So what we're doing, our research is precisely to see whether there could be mechanism to foster that, to promote that kind of interaction. In more urban areas, you have more and more of that. In the rural areas, parents do care a lot about their kids. We ask them about the aspiration that they have for their kids. A lot of them want their kids to be ministers, to be doctors, and nurse was very popular as well. But they just don't know what they need to do to accompany the child because they don't have education themselves. You know, most of us, most people my age in sub-Saharan Africa, are the first generation to acquire this formal Western-style education. So to go back in the villages and actually inform parents about the choices that they have, the power that they have, what they can do, you know, relative to the capacity that they have to encourage the child to pursue and work hard at school, is the kind of policies we're trying to evaluate. So this is not to say, in fact, that would be very mistaken to suggest that these parents maybe care less about their kid in any way. They care a lot, and they have very high aspiration for the kids. Our assumption is that they just don't have, they don't know what they need to do, and we're trying to promote that. Again, like I said, we evaluated in Gambia a very comprehensive program, but what we found out is that when it comes to critical things where it's important to actually go and open a book and figure out things, that's where it's, you know, things stop functioning. But parents come to meetings. We invite them to come and meet the teachers and discuss the problems in the villages. But what would happen a lot of time, again, you have this meeting and ultimately it's the teacher or the head teacher who is supposed to be supervised by the community. He is the most knowledgeable person in that meeting and leading actually the meeting. So you make it very hard to work. But what this means is basically that as researchers and as policymakers, we just have to have more realistic objectives for what parents can do and then push harder for that.
Well, I'm curious. I have to ask about how your research in Africa, in these particular countries, I mean, your own experience in Togo, your research in Benin and in the Gambia, how generalizable is that across Africa? I mean, are you seeing very similar problems across the continent? And would you consider these to be very similar problems that perhaps other countries and other regions of the world face, or perhaps even in the United States we face?
Absolutely. So you see, when I talk about the decentralization of school management, if I want to draw a parallel with the U.S., that would be, you know, sort of the charter schools trying to get something a little more independent, more autonomy in the management of the school, and expect that, you know, you'll have more competition, more accountability in particular to improve learning outcome. When it comes to early childhood investment, education is an economy. In the U.S. here, it's a huge debate about the minorities, for example, the African Americans, you know, what are part of the problems in terms of them not having higher achievements in education, you know, the gap in an achievement measures, achievement measurement that people are having now. So what is emerging from there as well is that, look, education is not just what is happening in the classroom. What is happening at home within the households are crucial. It's much more important than anything else. And Nobel laureate Heckman is actually one of the pioneers of this. He's showing how, you know, despite some of the highest achievement that you could get on the paper, in the books and all that, when you go back and look at how people are doing in life in general, some of the most explanatory variables come in the early childhood part of their lives. What happened in their families in the first few years in terms of learning manners, learning how to behave in a society, how to fit, and how to do very basic things. So this is the motivation. So this problem is a general problem, but the prescription cannot necessarily be general. The prescription is going to be context-specific. And when we're talking about Africa, when we're talking about the kind of research I'm doing, it's extremely different than the U.S. The context is very different. You don't have the infrastructure that you have here. You don't have the level of education that we have on average in the United States here, and that make it very different. So whatever conclusion we will draw there is very moderately that it could be generalized to other places.
Same problem, different solutions. Well, just to go back really quickly to the incentive and that the job later in life is an incentive. But tell us, Musa, I mean, some of the work you're doing now has to do with youth unemployment. And that clearly is connected to this issue of education, because even if you have access and you have a good education and you end up an educated person in some of these countries, you may not even be able to find a job. So how does that connect to all of this, and what does it mean for the future of education in Africa?
That's a huge problem. In Africa, there's a conference that I'm invited to attend in Paris where the focus is basically on youth unemployment and secondary education. You know, in the 60s, when most of the African countries got independence, the focus was to train very quickly people and position them in the public administration. And so back then, education translated to getting instruction and then having a job after. That mentality hasn't changed. So the higher education system needs to be reformed so that some of the students coming out of it have a mindset that they should be entrepreneurial, create job, and not be only job seekers. And if Africa is able to get that transformation, it would be great. Otherwise, all the growth and all the transformation that people have been talking about the past 20 years is going to become in question, because a lot of people feel like they are educated. They have a bachelor's degree, master's degree, but they don't have jobs that correspond to that. And that could be the next challenge. And that's the kind of research I'm engaging in going forward now.
Really fascinating, Musa. Thank you so much for being with us today and sharing your insight about this really important topic. Thank you.
Thank you. It's my privilege to be invited to this show. Thank you.
You've been listening to my conversation with University of Oklahoma economist and International and Area Studies professor Musa Blimpo. We have a transcript of this interview and more information about this show online at kgou.org. OU's College of International Studies produces Worldviews through a collaborative partnership with KGOU. Brian Hardzinski produces the show, and Symphony Swift prepares the research for our interviews and books our guests. For Keith Gaddy, I'm Suzette Gorlott.